Hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. How are you? What did you eat really fast?
I had a really random dinner because I'm going back to Scotland tomorrow, so I'm using what I have. And what I had was celeriac, a whole celeriac. So I made a large majority of that into like air fryer chips,
Wait, I'm
with
sorry. Courgette.
celeriac. It's delicious. Well, it's a
No,
bit.
wait. Are we thinking about the same thing?
Celeriac's not courgette, no.
What is celeriac?
Celeriac's like a root veg.
Oh, okay. And is it like it tastes a bit like aniseedy.
Kinda, yeah. And it's like a round ball
Yeah, I get
thing.
it. It's got those little balls at the top.
So I had that like kind of like fries with Linda McCartney sausages and some peas. And then I had half of a leftover cupcake. It was very good, but I probably condensed the time that was required to eat it a little bit too much. And I struggle to eat fast at the moment, which is not a bad thing. But if I eat too fast, it's like someone's just gone like into my stomach, and then it's like all of a sudden.
That's
It's
ideal. I guess
quite
your
delicious.
space for your stomach is smaller.
Yeah, and I think it's also I just get indigestion, so I think it's just
You
that I need to.
basically have a gastric band.
If I wasn't eating all the time, I would agree.
Have you read anything exciting this week?
I don't think so. I've been doing some of my own studying this week. I'm doing a pre and postnatal course, and it's very good so far. And learning more about diastasis and pelvic floor, etc. So that's been exciting, but I have nothing exciting to share from it hugely yet. But we'll feedback anything that I do, because it's more for my own interest more than anything else. It's been a while since I learned something for myself that's not from, like a research paper, which, it can get a bit tedious sometimes.
Yeah, that's good.
Have you?
I've more been looking at like a behavioral science research around marketing rather than anything nutrition based. So no, not really.
Anything exciting from it?
So far a lot of it has just been like stuff I already know, but like it still always blows my mind. But I just like the studies that prove it, even though they're just thinking of different ways to apply it. But yeah, it was good.
Okay, well, let's just get on with the question, shall we?
Let's.
Our useless information start this podcast today. Okay, Lucy's question. I have a client who's struggling with feeling unwell after certain foods. She has spoken to her GP, who tested for diabetes and said her blood sugars were a little low but not problematic. This is what she reports feeling. I would say generally it happens about 10 to 15 minutes after consumed. Mainly my tongue tingles and I feel very drunk, like the feeling of having had a couple of bottles of wine. That's very drunk. It can last about an hour, then I get really tired. I started to be more aware of it near the end of last year after I had an ice cream and struggled to stand afterwards as I felt that extreme drunk feeling. I ended up having to go to bed and sleep for about 12 hours. I try to avoid certain foods and drinks now. However, things like the berries doing it makes it difficult. I noticed it also last week with my porridge when I hadn't done a workout that morning. She reports often feeling dizzy and thirsty too. Any insight into what might be happening or what she can advocate for with GP support?
Oh, she 100% needs to go back to the GP and do some kind of, because what won't show is it sounds like how she's managing glucose or something that's happening when she's eating, it isn't working particularly well. But what that won't necessarily show is fasting glucose or HbA1c, which is probably the two things that they'll check. That your HbA1c might be quite normal because that's like the average of your glucose over time, and your fasting glucose might be quite normal. But what they don't normally do, and I actually don't know if many GPs do this, but like an oral glucose tolerance test, which would be quite hard to do because normally you do it over 2 hours. This actually might be a case where having a glucose monitor And if she can't get it from the doctor, then testing herself and seeing what does happen over that time. Because, I mean, until relatively recently, when these became so readily available, which normally we talk about as like a kind of overcomplication and generally quite a bad thing, this might be a good example of where she might be able to get some data for herself and then bring it to the GP and say, this is what's happening. From hearing that, that sounds to me quite extreme. Like, I would be going back and self-advocating. Like, if my doctor sent me away and I was like, I, you know, after eating, like, my tongue goes tingly and I have to go to bed, like, that's not normal. It does kind of make me think there are slight similarities between, like, how some people manifest migraines, but if she's not getting, like, general headachey pain, then probably not that. But I'm just thinking, like, the tingliness, I sometimes get that. But I would be going back to the doctor.
I agree. I don't really have anything else to say. I would be mindful of suggesting, like, when you said, you know, what else it could be, I would be very mindful of suggesting to somebody in this situation what might be happening. It sounds to me a little bit like she might be a little bit educated in this, and because of the information she's given you, like, well, when I don't work out, this happens. Or like, she, I feel a little bit like you have to be mindful sometimes, because you can fall into like a self-diagnosis hole. And I'm not, this is by no means saying that this is what this person is doing at all, but sometimes if someone in a position of authority or power or what feels like power to you says, oh, maybe it could be this, we all know those people. We've maybe even been these people where we Google it and then we go, oh, that's me. And then we self-diagnose, and then that can kind of hinder, I think, it's useful to get some information right, but I think it can sometimes hinder the support that you get. So I wouldn't really put any more of an opinion on it other than, you know, what Em was saying about different tests.
Mm-hmm.
Victoria's question. Two questions. Number one, are vegan omega-3 supplements as good or beneficial as fish-based? The fishy burps after taking the supplement can be a bit grim, and although I don't currently have any vegan clients, it'd be good to know if they ask. Just take it at night. That's what I've had to do all the way through my pregnancy, because it's just not ideal for me.
I always take supplements at night. Mainly because, you know, there might be a, I want to do everything I can to build muscle. And if there's a slight effect of having extra antioxidants and maybe not adapting as well to exercise, like, why not? It makes no difference to me to take it at night. And I train in the morning. So,
yeah.
I didn't really think about that, but the benefit of not having fishy burp.
Yeah. I think, so not all vegan supplements are the same. So some of them are ALA and they are much lower in terms of bioavailability than omega-3 that you would get in like a fish, a non-vegan supplement. But some vegan supplements are like quite high in similar fatty acids, DHA, EPA. And so they're great. But I imagine that the vegan supplements that are in that form are probably very expensive, infinitely more expensive than, and actually there's some research around like quality of omega-3 supplements in general being quite poor. And actually I think it is one of those supplements where when you pay for like top grade, you do get better ones, or, you know, higher concentrations, etc. So if you're not vegan, I would recommend you stick to normal omega-3. If someone is vegan, then I would recommend that they look for like a preformed EPA, DHA, as opposed to an ALA. Ones that are ALA are, they're not useless, but I wouldn't bother. So that technically means they're useless.
Whenever I get asked about like fish oil or omega-3, it's hard because you're probably right in that, you know, the ones that you pay more for are probably better. But you also don't know that it's not just marketing shit. And it's like, oh, let's just take these Tesco ones and put them, because no one's really checking this stuff.
Yeah, like all supplements, you just like, you never fully know, which is a scary thing.
Yeah.
The second question, type 2 diabetes. Ooh. Is it genetic or is it more of a nurture versus nature thing? If you've grown up in an environment of poor food choices and lack of activity, would you be more likely to develop type 2 diabetes because you're copying the same behaviours as your parents, as opposed to an actual genetic element? My dad has type 2, so when both my sister and I were pregnant, we had to get the gestational diabetes test. We both came back negative, but then we were both a healthy weight and physically active, whereas he was not. The next is something else.
Both. So there can be, well, there are genetic predispositions. The primary one being where you store body fat. So people generally of South Asian origin will store more body fat around their central. Why has that just got, oh, viscerally, that's the word. Which means that even at a, like a lower BMI, and even when they are quite active, they have a higher risk of type 2 diabetes. But it sounds like your dad was less of a genetic risk and more of like a lifestyle risk. But that doesn't necessarily mean that even the nurture side isn't like passed on, right? Like we know that people who come from families that have obese parents are like their children are more likely to be obese, probably because of the habits that are then passed on. And there might be genetic predisposition there. So I guess you could argue as well that if you're, I don't know, genetically predisposed to put on weight, then you might also argue that you're genetically predisposed to have a higher risk of type 2 diabetes via that. But there are certain, like, you can be pretty lean, or at least like not very overweight and develop type 2 diabetes if you're storing body fat in certain places, which isn't fair, but that's just why we see so much higher rates in certain populations.
Steve Redgrave has type 2 diabetes, Olympic rower, and that was, they assume, genetically driven. He's
Really?
didn't, yeah, because he got diagnosed with it whilst he was an athlete. It's not like as he got older, but he had, yeah, it was strongly linked to family stuff, like family history. I think. Yeah, I don't have a huge amount to say. It's both. I think I'd be really mindful of, it's not just like learned behaviors. It's also
Economic status.
all of the stuff that, yeah, and like the socioeconomic impact of for certain families that leads to their behaviors and their choices. And we need to be really mindful when we're talking about things like type 2 or obesity, where it's like, oh, they just learned not to eat well, or they learned not to exercise. And for sure, there is a lot of modeling behaviors and, you know, the values that you take on from your family, but it's not, I think we need to be really mindful of the personal responsibility narrative. Like, for sure, there's personal responsibility in all of our choices, et cetera, et cetera. But when it comes to things like type 2, for example, you know, some people are more prone to it because of, you know, the availability that they have to healthful food or movement or education around these things. And so it's a very multifaceted thing, but it's, yeah, genetic and probably lifestyle combo. Just been listening to episode 43 of the EIQ podcast and the chat about intuitive eating. So that was probably last week, I guess, right? And our behaviors back when we were cave people got me thinking about yo-yo dieting. It seems like yo-yo dieting or binge restrict cycles mimic the abundance famine pattern of those times. Just ruminating. That's something you've mentioned before, so I'm not going to say anything.
Yeah, I don't think most people now yo-yo diet for those reasons. I think it's more to do, well, I mean, it depends on the population, but most women I work with, like it's more to do with over-restriction and diet culture and cutting out food and trying to drop too low on their calories and then swinging back the other way and perfectionist mindset and all or nothing tendencies, as opposed to like a feast fat. Well, yeah, maybe there's a slight link. Yeah.
Yeah, with binge eating, there's doesn't seem to be any link. Like, there's never, when you look at the research around binge eating, it's never, oh, it's because it's driven physiologically through this mechanism. Like, for sure, there might be some physiological drive in terms of deprivation, restriction, etc. But I wouldn't ever relate it to that. It's one of those things of like, This is a good, like, just because something looks the same, it doesn't mean it's the same. That was a really
Wow.
I know I'm so profound. It's just getting more and it's getting more and more profound as time goes on. But you know what I mean, like that's it. I'm trying to think of an example, but I can. Yeah,
Yeah,
I
it's
don't
correlation, not causation. Or like, you know, there's links between the two, but isn't the inverse.
Yeah.
That's why that happens.
Yeah. Livy's question. Hi both, hope you're having lovely weeks. Apologies if I missed this, but are there any EIQ resources on supporting clients throughout pregnancy? If not, could you point me in the direction? I feel totally clueless. I guess I am after some practical advice regarding any specific foods that are worth prioritizing, how to work with any and all cravings and energy swings that come and go. This I'm going to do a mini series lecture for April, and I'm going to do the following for the last one. So I'll do nutrition and pregnancy for grads. So you will get all of that there. Realistically, I would definitely watch the Trying to Conceive Fertility mini series lecture if you've not watched that already. In terms of dietary patterns, similar sort of dietary pattern recommendations are there. Mediterranean style type of diets, shockingly. But realistically, in the first trimester, for most people, not all, but you'll be lucky if they want to eat a vegetable, maybe some fruit. Beck and I used to message each other with our daily punnet of grapes because that was like our thing that we could only have. So you just want to be mindful in the first trimester. Usually it's like, okay, well, you know that we're aiming for, you know, three servings of protein-ish and some fruit and vegetables. But if that fruit has to come from a glass of orange juice and some grapes in your cereal, that's fine. And not and like, supporting people to kind of normalize that in the first trimester as they take their prenatals. The one thing I would say, most prenatals in the UK have iodine in them, but just that is one, and I'll go into this in the lecture, but it's one supplement that I would really recommend that you make sure someone's taken from the get-go in their first trimester is folate or folic acid, a prenatal, and iodine if it's not within their prenatal. But the main ones, like the main ones in the UK, they do have it. If they're in different countries, much less likely.
Yeah, it is interesting. Like most people are like, oh, well, this is the most important time in my life to, you know, like nail my nutrition. So you go in with all these like great expectations and like, oh, I wanted it. And then it's like, okay, well, what can you actually stomach? Because that's probably the most important thing.
Yeah, exactly that. And often, for this is purely anecdotal from people I've spoken to and my own experience. A lot of the foods that you have up until the point of pregnancy, you don't want any of them, any of them. So if you've got someone who has a really varied diet, eats a lot of protein, and then you're like, okay, let's have a varied diet and eat a lot of protein, a lot of those sources of food is like, absolutely not. And that might not come back until second trimester. And it's not every day, but yeah, most people have these. I mean, I would have been like, yeah, I'll nurture, I'll have smoothies, it'll be fine, I'll figure out a way. She did not figure out a way. That's okay. We survive. Okay, Laura's question. Supplement question. Actually, no, supplement quesi. I feel like quesi needs to get in there. My client is type 1 diabetic and notices her menstrual cycle affects her insulin sensitivity. Blood glucose, but that her cycle is inconsistent, and so it's hard to predict how she will be month to month. She bought inositol and NAC or N-acetylcysteine, and she's heard they can help regulate insulin sensitivity. I know inositol has been shown to be helpful, however, I'm not seeing anything re-insulin and NAC. What are your thoughts? Read both these two supplements for insulin sensitivity in type 1 diabetics.
Never looked at type one. Did you look at this?
I looked at it a bit, yeah. My overarching thing here is I wouldn't be trying to manipulate blood glucose with supplements with someone who has type 1 unless they're working with their doctor. Most people with type 1 should be managing this or, you know, are in the process of doing that. It is true that you get changes in insulin sensitivity throughout your cycle. So you do get slightly less insulin sensitive in your luteal phase. So that's pretty normal. If anything, I would say track your cycle and see what's going on in terms of regularity of that and try and work on restoring regularity of that. And then that will become a little bit more cyclical in terms of the slight shifts, so that she can feel like she's got a bit more quote unquote control. But yeah, there's some evidence for both of those supplements, and type one.
I feel
But again,
like they'd be somewhat less effective in type 1, depending on like who she is and like how active she is. Because normally it's not so much the insulin sensitivity that's the problem in type 1, it's the lack of insulin.
Are there some that specifically there was, I don't know if it was a review or a paper that I read, that looked at specifically N-acetylcysteine and diabetes, and there were some suggestions that it's tissue specific, which is not hugely physiological relevant on a whole body person. But there were some other bits of evidence that suggest, yeah, they may see improvements in insulin sensitivity. It's not a supplement I've ever recommended. I've never actually recommended any specific supplements to someone with type 1. But obviously, of course, exercise is a prime example of something that's going to help regulate their blood sugar. So, like, that is something I've recommended before. So, the only thing that I would just be really mindful and say, I don't think there's anything wrong with necessarily taking these, particularly if she's working to take these in conjunction with a medical professional.
Yeah, I think it's a good reminder of like type 1 is significantly different to type 2. Like if you improve someone's insulin sensitivity and they've got type 2 diabetes, it's like fucking great. You know, it may be caveat to that if they're insulin dependent type 2s, and then you'd have to watch like how much insulin you're or they're taking. But with type 1, it's like, well, that is going to have to be, you know, if they are effective to the extent that you then need to reduce your insulin dose, like that would be something again to make sure that they're speaking to their diabetes team about before they start taking supplements.
Yeah, totally agree. Okay, Anna's question. Hi, ladies. I hope you are well. This is a personal question, so I'll give a bit of context. Years ago, I did a blood test for lactose intolerance and it was positive. Since then, I have been trying to avoid dairy products. But in the last year, I have noticed that even when I have lactose-free products, I still get symptoms and they are different now. The symptoms I get are constipation, stomach ache, cramping, and bloating. I was wondering if this could be intolerance to casein. Not sure if this is a thing, but in the podcast about hypertrophy, at the end, you girls spoke about enzymes, and I was wondering on this case, would enzymes to break down casein may help? Or is it possible that it's just a waste of money? Or could it be also the case that because I have been avoiding any dairy products, when I have it, I get the symptoms listed above? I really appreciate your answer, as this has been annoying me for a while and I just want to have cheese.
Love that ending.
No. Feel you. I don't know where you got your blood tests from, but there are like breath tests that you can get that are clinically relevant with the doctor. So I would double check that just in case. Just in case, I would check that. It could be a casein intolerance. It could be that you've not had them for ages and then you're reintroducing them. It just seems a bit weird that you've got diagnosed as lactose intolerance, and then now it's like, well, maybe it's not lactose, unless again the test was not a good quality test. The thing with casein, lactose is an intolerance. Casein would be an allergy, but the thing with casein is that it's like the curds in the way, right? It's like the curd, it's slower digesting. So you might, if you notice a reaction almost immediately, I'd say, and again, this is not a specific scientific diagnostic tool, but if it's immediate, it's probably less likely to be a casein response, I would think, because of the time it takes potentially for a casein to digest, assimilate, etc. But again, that's not a definitive thing. There's no way of knowing other than keeping a food diary and going to speak to a medical professional about specific tests, because you're all of these questions are like valid and could be yes.
There was something I was thinking when she was talk when you were reading it out. I get the other thing, and this like might seem like a bit of a reach. But there's quite good research on this, like double blind research, where they give people who are like, you know, gluten intolerant, gluten, or who think that they're, you know, intolerant to gluten. Obviously, they don't give actual celiac gluten, that get through ethical approval. But people who have like a self-diagnosed gluten intolerance, they give them gluten but say it's not gluten and they don't get symptoms. And the people who basically, if you think that you're eating gluten, you often get the symptoms of gluten intolerance. And to the extent of like, because you might be thinking, yeah, but like I'm actually having like constipation here, or, you know, like a real physical, to the extent of that, like, you know, people feeling really nauseous, throwing up, like having diarrhea, like genuine real physical symptoms because they think that they have, like, it is. And whenever I read that kind of stuff, I'm like, yeah, I still don't fully believe it, but it's like it, but it does happen.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that time and time again. So it might be a case of that, like if you fully believe that you're lactose intolerant. I know that what you're eating you don't think has lactose in, but if it's like dairy-esque, you know, like a lactose-free yogurt or something, then potentially you might be having those symptoms because your body kind of expects them.
Fine.
Emily's just saying the test for lactose intolerance is a hydrogen breath test, though. I didn't think there was a blood one.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. The breath test is a standard test, is a hydrogen breath test. So I'm not, that's why I'm not sure about that blood test. But I don't know. It could be different where you live. I'm not sure. But
definitely good to get retested. But then it does seem like there is something, you know, whether it's the degree or not. I mean, great if that means you can eat some cheese and you're not
all we're after
lactose intolerant. But imagine how pissed you'd be if you, I don't know, cut out like gluten and lactose for years. And then they were like, yeah, we need to do that. You're like, what?
But then I bet there's so many people, like, you know, people with PCOS, for example, and they get all of that crap information around cutting out food groups and stuff. And then they're like, they come and work with someone that's a EQ coach and they're like, oh yeah, there's actually, like, I understand why you've been told this and why you think this, but there's actually no evidence that this is even remotely beneficial and probably is increasing your risk of overeating and binge eating and eating disorder. So let's bring it back in. Be like, oh, it's a revelation.
I spoke to a woman the other day who did commit 6 years ago, and this was in a slightly different context, but she's like, whenever I talk about you, I tell everyone that you're the woman who let me eat, like, you know, enjoy sandwiches again. And she's like, that was like the biggest thing. She's like, now I can eat bread and like I don't freak out about it. And she's like, I love a sandwich. And I'm like,
oh, little things though. But it's those things that are just like,
imagine how many good sandwiches you've missed.
Love a sandwich. Okay. I've not seen this question. Okay, Natalie's question. Hi both, I hope you're having a lovely week. One question I have, probably, which is most likely a very simple, silly question. Slap you on the wrist for that one, compassionately. No silly questions. And well, I mean, there are, but I'm sure it's not. In regards to protein intake from the lecture on hypertrophy, recommended amounts for optimum uptake and use by the body at around 20 to 25 grams per meal, and with more not adding huge benefit, if at all, just saturation. What happens when more is consumed? Is it just a case of excess energy if consuming more than expenditure? If consuming more than expenditure, then weight gain. I often get asked what happens if you eat too much protein, probably with the misinformation around it on harming kidneys. Just wondering how to answer it correctly when I've been asked.
Yeah, I would just broadly say, like, it's excess calories. It still might fill you up more. You know, there still might be benefits to it. Especially as you age, there might be benefits to more as well. And there is more recent research coming out that, like, you do still see, like, you're right in kind of like what you've taken from that lecture. You don't get that much extra benefit. If you're looking at like law of diminishing returns, like, yeah, it's worth getting in 20 to 25 grams, but then like over and above that, you're not seeing as much benefit. That's assuming you're in a population that's young, fit, healthy, and you don't have a huge amount of muscle mass. Then there are like more specific studies that look at like grams per kilogram muscle mass, or per kilogram body weight, more to the point, but per meal. So you'd have a more specific, like, this is roughly what's going to stimulate it for you. The reason that most people don't do that is just kind of like overcomplicates things unnecessarily. And for most people, aiming for about that is a good aim. But will, for example, like older women or older men get more benefit from having like 30 to 40 grams a meal? Yeah.
Mm. I also think too, around training, there's some good evidence around, like, you know, full body training, as opposed to single leg, which often a lot of the protein research is done in single leg research, or, you know, single limb research. And 20 to 25 grams seems to saturate muscle protein synthesis in a single leg. But actually, when you look at full body, up to 40 grams is potentially helpful. So again, in that situation, I would go higher. But again, without the risk of overcomplicating for most of the people that we work with. But yeah, excess calories, and beyond that point, nothing to do with kidneys though. One client I've been working with, I am wondering if this is binge, if this is binge eating disorder, and would need a referral. Things he says a lot is, oh, this is long. I don't know if I've got this space in my ear cavity to read this one. Okay. Often says that he will make his lunch and bring it into work, but then sees what others have and wants their food, or makes food and creates extra for lunches the next day, but has evening meal and knows it's in the fridge and eats it later, or even though he didn't need it. Or canteen food opts for a jacket potato with tuna and salad, as he says it's the healthier option, but wants lasagna or sausage and chips and feels hungry later and not satisfied. Maybe we should go through these as kind of, that's okay actually. Doesn't feel full even with more protein on his plate. Always focused on meals and timings. Said he eats, but is already thinking when his next break is, what he's going to eat, and already thinking the meal he's eating isn't going to fill him up. Constantly wants cooked breakfast or fantasizes on this food. Goes to all you can eat places, even though he has no control over food. Can't use calorie tracking or even think of it as that way, as it creates a panic sensation. He says, sees his breakfast and sees it as 600 calories, then thinks, oh my God, I only have so many left, and often leads to eat more. Has had binge behaviors in the past and still does eat more than intended on some foods he labels as naughty, lots of food rules, and feels his body just wants to store fat, identifies a lot as a larger body. Shift worker with breaks being sporadic and unsure when the next break is, so feels not sure when the next break is, so he needs to eat, eats when he's not hungry, and often sees food, then wants it. I'm wondering if this more of a disordered eating specialist help he needs a referral to beat. How to tell if a clinical disorder, if it's a very poor relationship with food itself. If you're not on the grads program yet, on the grads program, we do have a mini series lecture that I did on disordered eating, eating disorders, when to refer out. So if you, once you've finished EIQ, you'll get that, and that will go into this in a lot more detail. The only thing in there that flags up to me as binge eating disorder is a loss of control. But that's when we're looking at binge eating specifically, that's the kind of one of the key distinguishers, is this feeling of a complete loss of control. If you're unsure, look up the DSM-5 criteria. DSM-5 criteria for binge eating disorder. And that will give you some insight. It sounds to me like very disordered eating behaviors, thoughts, practices. If you don't know how to deal with these things, and I 100% would refer out, maybe you're just not at that stage yet. Like, maybe you're still working through EIQ, and you know, this might always be, feel like that's not the type of person that you're comfortable working with, and that's totally fine. But it does sound to me like disordered eating, and there are so many things to unpack there that would take, you know, more than an entire podcast probably to go through, in terms of food neutrality, dichotomous thinking, food rules, food preoccupation, hunger dysregulation. Like, there's so much there to kind of unpack. So I wouldn't think that from the, it's, we can't say, if we can't say we don't work with the client, right? But that would be my thoughts.
Yeah, I agree. I think in these sort of situations where I'm like, kind of, I mean, it, from where I am now, I would refer out, but it, previously I might have taken someone on like this, but I probably explained to them like, look, this is the side I can help with, this is what I do, does that sound like what you want? If so, let's work together for X amount of months, see how we go, and if I need to refer you on, then I'll refer you on. And even then, I think the other thing that we often almost forget is like, you know, that it sounds like he needs a therapist as well, or some kind of like maybe a counselor, or, you know, some kind of support on that front of the way that he's looking at himself and how he's talking to himself, and maybe that preoccupation. Like, it sounds like he's thinking about food a lot. And if that's quite deep, then hey, maybe you refer him to someone for everything. But there are a lot of people who have come to you for a specific reason, right? Like, they really like you, or they gravitate towards your stuff, they want your help. And it's fine to say, hey, I can help you with this stuff, and I can write your training programs, and I can support you with this mindset stuff, and I can help you with like healthy habits and a morning routine and getting your life sorted and some more organization and planning ahead and all this kind of stuff. But with that side, it sounds like you might need some more support. Have you thought about this? That's fine as well. You don't have to be everything to everyone. And I think as coaches, like, we put so much pressure on ourselves to do that, of like, well, I need to help them with X, Y, and Z. Like, the amount of people I take on and they're like, oh, I'm doing Hyrox. I'm like, okay, great. I'm assuming your Hyrox coach coaches you with that. Yeah. I just want to come to you for the other stuff. Okay, cool. I don't do Hyrox training. So that's fine. Like, you don't need to do all of it for everyone.
Agreed. And that's it.
Okay, great.
Thanks, everyone.
Okay.
Bye.